From the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. It was the war that gave us the term ethnic cleansing. In the early 1990s, the country formerly known as Yugoslavia collapsed, and the area known as Bosnia-Herzegovina, militaries from three ethnic groups, Catholic Croats, Orthodox Christian Serbs, and Muslim Bosniaks, battled in an effort to eradicate other ethnicities from parts of the country. 20 years ago, a NATO bombing campaign against the Serbs led to the U.S.-brokered Dayton Accords. That deal ended the slaughter in Bosnia, but not before 110,000 people had died and about half of the region's population of 4.4 million had been forced from their homes. Earlier this year, the battle-scarred country formally applied for membership in the European Union, a major milestone in its recovery from the war. But Bosnia faces huge challenges still. Its income per capita is about one-tenth that of Germany, and Transparency International ranks it as one of the most corrupt countries in Europe. Even more challenging is that the Dayton Accords formalized ethnic segregation, with the country divided into a Serbian Republic and a Federation of Bosnia and Herzegovina made up of Bosnians and Croats. On this edition of Global Journalist, a look at the huge challenges ahead for a divided nation with a bloody past and an uncertain future. We've got a couple great guests joining us from Annapolis, Maryland, Kurt Bessiner, Senior Associate and Co-Founder of the Democracy Policy Council, and from Sarajevo in Bosnia, Sreko Latal, Regional Editor at Balkan Insight and the Founder of the Social Overview Service. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you for having me.
Mr. Natal, you're in Sarajevo right now. Tell us just a little bit about ordinary life in Bosnia 20 years after the war. Do children from different ethnic groups, do they go to school together? Do people intermarry across ethnic lines? How does the sort of reconciliation on the ground look?
Well, it's difficult to explain in a few sentences, but essentially it's clear that the war has left deep scars on a tissue of the local society. The country was devastated. The infrastructure was destroyed. People were ethnically and politically divided, and much has been fixed, especially in the first 10 years, mainly thanks to quite strong international engagement in the country. But unfortunately, what we are witnessing for the past 10 years, essentially since 2006, is a gradual worsening of the political, economic, and social situation, which came as international community stopped putting so much effort into the implementation of the peace accord. And as you said, the country has applied for the EU membership, but the country is haunted by serious, deep political and personal mistrust among top political leaders, by very weak civil society, divided societies, and I believe that the country is definitely not going in the right direction and requires, once again, serious international attention.
And Mr. Bessiner, we heard Sreko Latal talking about some of the divisions in the country. To someone going to Bosnia for the first time, how are those divisions evident on the ground?
Well, just as a note, I mean, I'm also resident in Sarajevo. I've been there for just under 11 years now. I just happen to be here where I am now. I think the most evident thing, the actual physical scars of war are visible if you know how to look for them, but they don't jump right out at you the way they did immediately after the war, even a decade ago. But I think the most evident way you see the division is if you understand the nature of the media coverage in the region, or just talk to your average person. There's a deep sense of innate dysfunction of politics in Bosnia, and I think that's fundamentally the root cause of the diagnosis that Sreko just gave, which I largely agree with. There's deep dissatisfaction with the entire political elite, not just those who purportedly represent your group, but everybody. And that's the I sort of arrived at the apogee of the progress that Sreczko delineated. And I agree, it's sort of parabolic. For the first 10 years, there was progress. In the last 10 years, there's been regression. And that is a result of international retreat, the European Union, which hasn't been mentioned yet, taking the leadership role. And the idea was that the offer of European Union membership was going to solve this. And I think that has been proven wrong over the past decade, but it hasn't been fundamentally reassessed. So I think the divisions that Sreczko mentioned are most evident in the media environment and in discussions that you have with your cab
driver.
So
in other words, people from one ethnic group will watch one TV channel, people from another ethnic group will watch another?
Well, there's that, but there's definitely media sort of division. But I think that there's a lot more commonality than meets the eye, too, in the sense that there's disgust with everybody. If you asked your average Bosnian of any flavor, Bosniak, Serb, Croat, or other, because there are people who don't want to fit in those boxes, what they thought of their politicians, they'd usually spit out with venom that they think they're all crooks. And unfortunately, there's a lot of evidentiary basis to back that claim. So,
well, before we reach this point, let me turn it back to you, Sreczko, because I think it's important to maybe go over how the Bosnian government works. There was an article in The Guardian recently calling it the world's most complicated system of government now. Can you give our listeners just a brief overview of sort of Bosnia's, how does Bosnia's government operate?
Well, Bosnian government is divided in 14 different, let's say, subunits. We have the state level, then the state is divided into entities, Federation of Bosnia and Herzegovina and Republika Srpska. Republika Srpska is actually quite centralized and streamlined. The other entity, the federation, consists of 10 cantons with significant responsibilities on the administrative, economic, and social level. And then, in addition, we have Brčko district and something like 160 municipalities. So on paper, it looks as very complicated, hard to manage apparatus. It is very expensive. But what is interesting is, for example, and then this is something that we are seeing as of lately, the situation seems to be somewhat better in the Federation in terms of both political and economic consensus rather than in Republika Srpska, which is extremely streamlined and centralized. And this shows that Bosnia and Herzegovina, despite its complicated system, can work if there is a political willingness among political elites and the rest of society to make the system work.
So in other words, then, there is this sort of federal government structure, and then the country is cloven in two, basically, between this Republic of Srpska, an area where you said the government operations are fairly streamlined, and this Federation of Bosnia-Herzegovina, which is just Bosnians and Croats, and there the government system is much more diffuse then. Is that fair to say?
Exactly. Yes.
And correct me if I'm wrong, there are three different presidents of Bosnia as well.
Yes, I mean, not three different presidents, but we have the three-member presidency. So three members of the presidency, they rotate every 8 months on the position of the chairman of the presidency, and they make the decision jointly, and each of them has a possibility of veto.
And one is from the Bosniak ethnic group, one from the Croat, one from the Serb.
Exactly.
Well, we're going to continue this discussion. I want to remind our listeners you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week, a look at the challenges in Bosnia as the country applies for membership to the European Union. Joining our show from Annapolis, Maryland is Kurt Basiner, Senior Associate and Co-Founder of the Democracy Policy Council. Also joining us from Sarajevo is Sreko Letal, a former AP correspondent and founder of a political research group called the Social Overview Service. If you're interested in more Global Journalist content, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read our ongoing series of interviews with journalists in exile around the world and coverage of foreign affairs and press freedom issues. We're also on social media. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at globaljourn. Mr. Basina, I wanted to ask you about an issue that you raised earlier. That is the issue of corruption. How do people in Bosnia experience corruption? Do they have to pay a bribe to get a driver's license or pay a bribe to City Hall to get a business license, or is it something more subtle than that?
Well, I mean, there's personal experience of corruption, and then there's the visibility of institutionalized corruption. I mean, I think the personal experience is most brutal in healthcare, because there you have the least negotiating power if your kid is sick or if you need medical treatment.
So wait, in healthcare, so you have to pay bribes to get access to healthcare then?
So yes. I've never personally experienced this, but then again, I'm not a citizen. But I know scores of people who have. It's considered de rigueur. And that is probably the most ugly experience of corruption. People pay off the police when they get pulled over. But I think that the way you have to think of corruption, I think we Westerners tend to think of corruption as an opportunistic infection, that if you have the right institutions and so forth, you could beat it back. It could be a controlled health condition. I think it's part of the institutional. I don't mean this in an anthropological way, but the Dayton system was designed around the political leaders who signed that deal being able to control public resources. And so politics is a for-profit enterprise. So delineating between politics, business, and organized crime in Bosnia is pretty much impossible. And that is the fundament of the problem. Corruption is a symptom of a lack of political accountability. It is not the disease itself. And I think there's, corruption as well as combating violent extremism are the two sort of international buzzwords you hear in Bosnia now, but both of them sort of miss the point. I mean, there's an institutional root to all of this, and it's the fact that people don't feel represented in governance, and they don't feel any way to leverage their opinion and get their concerns met institutionally. So it's the perverse incentives imbue the entire system. So everybody plays the game. Everybody's a rational actor. And so people participate in corruption because it's a way to get things done, but they don't feel good about it.
Well, let me turn that to Mr. Latal then. How do you see the issue of corruption in Bosnia? What are some of the more visible signs of it, and how come it hasn't been effectively addressed?
Well, I mean, first, what I would like to say is that, corruption here is endemic, but it is clear that the whole of the Balkans, all of the countries of former Yugoslavia have pretty similar levels of corruption. What Kurt said is absolutely true. I mean, the corruption is not the illness itself. It's just the indication of much deeper structural problems. And part of the problem is, we are usually focusing on politicians and blame them for the situation. But in Bosnia and Herzegovina, it should be said that the rest of the local community is equally to be blamed. There was one interesting thing that came up in one of my recent researchers at Analysis, which indicated that corruption has almost become a parallel system, because people who do not trust the administration, who do not trust the regular channels, be it in the education or in the health system, if someone's kid gets sick, people immediately start calling people who know people in the hospital. They're not even trying to go to hospital and get through the normal channels. And I have to say that the situation in Bosnia, compared to situation in the rest of the former Yugoslav countries, is getting worse and worse, because the country is divided in these two three main administrative units, and pretty much most of the life has been eaten up by politics.
And Mr. Bissener, I wanted to ask you about the role of other outside powers in Bosnia shaping its politics here, as Bosnia has applied to the European Union.
Mm-hmm.
We know that Russia was the ally of the Serbs during the war 2 decades ago. How does Russia influence Bosnian politics? Are there other foreign actors that are important?
Well, Russia has definitely changed a lot. That's a subject for another program. In the past 20 years, they while Russia was favorable to the Serbs, they're a hell of a lot more favorable now under Putin's management. But Russia's since the war, at least in the past, say, decade, but it's increased in say the past 5 years, has become much more of an opportunistic spoiler, taking advantage of the fact that the West doesn't have a unified and clear and strong strategic position. Turkey had been part of the West, effectively in policy up until relatively recently. I think that their own agenda has become much clearer as Mr. Erdogan has come under increasing domestic pressure, and they've gravitated back to their comfort zone of supporting the Bosniak Nationalist Party four square in a way that they were trying to diversify, say, 5 years ago. So the real what creates the opportunity for other actors, including investors from the Gulf states, which my colleague Valerie Perry has written about, taking advantage of malgovernance and just lack of transparency. The but for cause of all of that is that the West, which has a dominant position in terms of enforcing the Dayton Peace Agreement and has real power under the terms of that agreement, doesn't really have a cohesive strategy, because the European Union enlargement was supposed to solve all this, and we've never gone back to basics after recognizing that that's not working, that we need a different policy.
And Srećko Letal, Mr. Bisiner, he raised the issue of countries from the Gulf, particularly Saudi Arabia's influence in Bosnia. I understand that they have been funding some religious institutions there. How has that shaped society there?
Well, I mean, this influence has been present pretty much since the war, since 93, because at that time, in 93, the first groups of Mujahideens have started coming to Bosnia to help what they thought were their Muslim brethren in their fight. And some of them remained there after the war. Following the 9/11, most of these groups were cleared. But what we are seeing now is kind of the second wave in recent years, and different kind of influence and engagement, which differs from one country to another. I mean, for example, Gulf countries over the past 2-3 years have started investing heavily in Bosnia and Herzegovina, buying property, buying real estate. There are also, some NGOs, some of them are providing religious education to local people, which is different from the traditional teachings of Islam that have been practiced here for centuries. We have much more political engagement visible from Turkey. And as Kurt said, all these influences are reflected over Bosnia and Herzegovina as well as the rest of the Balkans, and to a certain degree, the situation looks quite similar to the situation just prior to the World War One, where we had the influences of Russia, of various European countries, Turkey, but also now America as well. Although, also as Kurt said, what we are seeing is less and less of the American and European engagement and influence, and much more of those others.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week, a look at the challenges in Bosnia as the country applies for membership in the European Union. Joining our show from Annapolis, Maryland, is Kurt Bisiner, Senior Associate and Co-Founder of the Democracy Policy Council. Joining us also from Sarajevo, Srećko Letal, a former AP correspondent and founder of a political research group called the Social Overview Service. Just to remind you, if you're interested in more Global Journalist, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read our ongoing series of interviews with journalists in exile around the world and coverage of foreign affairs and press freedom issues. We're also on social media. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at globaljourn. Kurt Bisiner, we have seen that in the past, as the EU has enlarged, they have been able to effectively bring about reforms in some countries like Slovenia or Croatia that have joined the EU. just by holding out the prospect of all the benefits, the economic benefits and other benefits that EU membership holds, how come that hasn't been effective in Bosnia so far?
Well, to be blunt, the Bosnian politicians have a better deal under the system they have now than anything the EU can offer them. And it's just rotten luck for the 99% of the population that are not prime beneficiaries of the system. There are a lot of lesser beneficiaries in government service, but the people who drive the black Audis are the ones who really call the shots, and they all tend to drive black Audis or be driven in them.
So, in other words, what you're saying is that by joining the EU, there would have to be a change in the status quo. The politicians wouldn't be able to enrich themselves. In other words, then
correct, and that's why these guys have left money on the table that they could have had by meeting EU standards. And that's why legislation that should have been passed years ago for various EU requirements has not been passed. A case in point is the fact that Bosnian farmers can't export their goods into Croatia, which they used to be able to do in a free trade arrangement. And they can't now, since Croatia joined the EU, not because of anything Croatia or the EU did, but what Bosnia didn't do. Part of this is a structural problem because Bosnia doesn't have an agriculture ministry. But it's a lack of political will to deal with this. And it's also a lack of political will on the part of the European Union to be more demanding. So the prevailing, you had mentioned the previous cases of where this worked. The prevailing assumption of European Union enlargement is that, you know, your politicians are democratically accountable. And ultimately, they answer to your citizens, and that they have an incentive to meet your standards. And Bosnia is a case where that's clearly not so. So it doesn't fit the model. And instead of calling them out on it, the EU's been faking progress, because what effectively we have, and not just for Bosnia, but Bosnia is a special case. You see this in Macedonia now too, is the overweening concern is stability. And stability works for people in power, and you see that all over the Mediterranean littoral. So if you want to be able to declare that your policy is working, you have happy talk, and you fake progress in the hope that it becomes real, or at least in the hope that things don't explode. But that's a policy that cannot succeed in the medium to long term.
Well, Srećko Letal, Kurt sees that there is a disconnect between what the Bosnian people want, which is membership in the EU, and what their politicians want, which is perhaps lip service to joining the EU, but no actual movement. Do you see things the same way? And given all the problems in the European now with the migration issue, with terrorism, with the UK potentially getting out, how appealing is membership in the EU for countries like Bosnia?
You ask the exactly right question, and this is the problem, that the changing of the EU context, which has been happening for the past 2-3 years, and the European Union is completely ignorant towards the fact that potential membership in the EU has changed. I mean, the picture of it, the benefits, the whole context has changed dramatically for remaining potential member countries. And I'm not only talking about Bosnia, but I'm talking about the rest of the Balkans. And although there is this general understanding, this mantra in the EU corridors that all other Balkan countries are moving very fast in the right direction, but maybe Bosnia and Macedonia. And although EU officials are trying to view or present a situation in Bosnia and Macedonia in a slightly positive manner, in my view, and pretty much there is a general understanding among most of the be it local or international experts, analysts, think tanks, academics across the region, that essentially the path of the whole of the West Balkans is pretty much closed towards the European Union as long as the European Union does not decide what it is and what it wants to be in a year, 2 or 3 years' time. And the problem is most visible, again, in Bosnia and right now in Macedonia, because business in these two countries is unfinished. I mean, these two countries are unfinished countries. And as we were saying for the past few minutes, I mean, there are conflicting ideas about the past, about the present, about the future of this country. I mean, many politicians are still pursuing the same ideas that their predecessors were pursuing just before the outbreak of the war, and because of these ideas that the country went into war for 3.5 years, and pretty much all three main ethnic goals remain the same, and political leaders today are pursuing these goals, but not with weapons, but by political means. And as long as the international community was willing and able to keep these politicians under control, there was illusion that the country was moving in the positive direction. But as I said, the moment this effort stopped, we've seen unraveling of pretty much most of the Dayton construct, which has been built painstakingly by the international and local community in the first 10 years after the war.
And Kurt Bussainer, our time does grow short, but I wanted to ask you briefly about the conviction earlier this year of the Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic. He was convicted of genocide and war crimes by the International Tribunal for Yugoslavia in The Hague. How has news of his conviction been greeted in Bosnia?
Well, I wasn't there physically for the conviction, but I definitely followed it. And as one would expect, there was disappointment on the part of some that the sentence wasn't long enough and that the genocide conviction did not extend to other localities beyond Srebrenica.
This was the site of the massacre where 8,000 Bosnian men and boys were killed, right?
But many would argue, and I would agree, that the genocidal policy began in 1992 and extended far wider. And in those cases, he was convicted of extermination, which is pretty about also heavy duty. And then on the Serb side, there was, oh, you see, they're always out to get us. We never could get a fair deal. So there were no real surprises in the response. I want to come back to very quickly.
Sure, our time does grow short. We have just about 20 seconds.
But you had mentioned reconciliation, and Srechko's last point about these agendas being pursued is simply the reconciliation's awfully hard when the conflict's not considered over, and the only people who can make it over are us, external actors. And we were doing that for the first 10 years after the war. We're no longer doing it. If we resume it, then we could finally get organic progress. Without it, we can't.
That's going to have to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri. Many thanks to Kurt Bussainer and Srechko Letal for joining us. Global Journalist executive producer is Joshua Kranzberg. Our supervising producer this week is Jinhong Chen, with associate producers Alexandra Beneva, Alex DeRosier, Inez Kagubari, and Joyce Tao. Our audio engineer is Pat Akers of KBIA. For all of us here at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.